Hey, can you hear me? Ah, okay. Interesting. So, I'm having thoughts right now, as I often do. I'm just thinking that thinking other people are bad is so lazy. It's such a lazy and uncurious way to go throughout life and throughout our journeys. Not only because of what it creates internally, right? So if we're having external thoughts about how people are bad and then other people are good, right? We create this paradigm where we're constantly terrified of being bad people, and oftentimes that is externalized outside of us, what's bad and what's good, or it's been programmed into us, and so that really is the root that a lot of our programming operates on, bad, good, and it's a lot of how structures like homophobia, racism, patriarchy, ableism, all of these things actually thrive on that fundamental belief system of good, bad, right, wrong. And so when we start judging other people through that lens of good or bad and saying certain other people are bad, labeling and judging them as bad, right, not their behaviors as harmful, not their reactions, not their impact as being misaligned, right, or unaligned, or disempowered, but that they themselves as people, as souls, are bad, what ends up happening is that we end up creating this hierarchy of value of people in the world, right? And there's good people, and they're more valuable and more lovable and more deserving of good things. And then there's bad people who deserve punishment and to be isolated and to be shamed and to be hurt, right? Is kind of where that thinking goes when there's no separation from the actions that someone is taking from them actually as a person. Then that level of thinking or that level of consciousness, it kind of automatically leads to violence, right? Whether it be psychic and emotional violence that we perpetuate on ourselves, right? The shaming, the blaming, the name-calling, all the things that we do to ourselves when we're quote-unquote bad, or even the people-pleasing and the, you know, saying yes when we mean no and all those things. That's also a form of psychic violence. It's a form of psychic violation with ourselves where we cross our own boundaries. We force ourselves outside of what is the realm of what we consent to in order to be good people. And so that whole structure, this good-bad structure, really is at the core subconscious root of a lot of mind control programs that we're operating on and that we're trying to free ourselves from and free others from. And they really form the root of a lot of systems of oppression within the world. So it's interesting because we have to look at them, especially as we begin to tackle some of these forms of oppression and these systems of oppression, right? Which is really like what it seems like we're up to as a culture right now in many areas and circles. Of people doing self-development work is there gets a point where you begin to realize like, oh man, yeah, I'm running programs that I don't want to be running and that I don't agree with and that, have been programmed into me by others, whether it be religion or family or culture, education system, mass media, right? All of these are programming you. The average child by the age of 5 years old has seen close to 300,000 advertisements. 300,000 advertisements. And these advertisements are formulated by people who are masters of psychology, masters of, I hate to use the word, but manipulation, right? So much of the branding and marketing that is out in the world in most industries. You know, what's cool about being a coach and in the self-development is that people are getting really conscious around the way they're branding and the energies that they're using, and branding from abundance and selling from abundance and creating really empowering, encouraging messages. So putting out branding and putting out messaging into the world that feels inspiring and expanding to interact with. That's not the case for the majority of corporate, you know, Fortune 500 companies. They're really selling to and operating at the level of consciousness of fear, of scarcity, of I'm not going to fit in. And so they drive those in and they create that, right? It's like the whole makeup industry, just not the whole makeup industry, but a large majority of the makeup industry is like, you know, call us ugly to sell us shit we don't need, right? And there's other avenues, and there's people who are doing cool stuff in the realms of self-expression with makeup. And, you know, so there is, like with the indie brands coming out in the makeup industry, there is a lot of kind of cool, unique messaging and expanding messaging around using makeup to actually express more of who you are, not to cover up or fit in, or, you know, because who you are without any makeup on is unacceptable. But, you know, when we look at the way that most corporations are selling and the most businesses are selling, it's through this paradigm of good, bad, as well, and programming. So, you know, and they're very advanced. They have these advanced, you know, degrees in marketing and logic and sales psychology and nervous system and all this stuff, and so they're using it to program their messaging into you. And so, you know, the average child by the age of 5 has seen 300,000 advertisements. They've been programmed before they can even really speak, right? It's wild to think of what this does to our brain. And we just have to be aware that we're all running programs that we didn't necessarily consent to running, or that might not even be in alignment with our highest values. And so where many people are on their self-development journey, especially if you are giving this work to other people and you are owning your leadership as a coach, is doing that work of dismantling these systems. And I think the first place that we often want to go as we are dismantling these systems is into that paradigm of good, bad, right and wrong. And it often leads us, it's like a loophole, it's a round trail where the trailhead like leads you right back to the beginning. Because if that's the level of consciousness that is forming and underpinning and supporting a lot of these systems of oppression, you can't get out of it while you're still in, while you're still thinking about the problem or trying to solve the problem from that level of consciousness, right? I think it was Albert Einstein, but I don't know who said it, but that you can never solve a problem at the same level of consciousness that you created it. So, you know, the thing that was really, you know, I'm going to talk, trigger warning, I'm just going to talk about George Floyd a little bit. I'm on a road trip right now, and I was just thinking about, I've been thinking a lot about policing in general. I was watching a documentary on YouTube. No, not YouTube. It was on Netflix. It's called How to Change Your Mind. It's amazing. And in the third episode, they're talking about this psychedelic therapist who's also on the police force. And it's so cool when you, like, see people start having perspective shifts from working with different psychedelic medicines and plant medicines, and like I call them mushroom thoughts. It's like I can kind of always tell, like, if somebody's worked with medicine, because they'll say things, I'm like, that's totally a mushroom thought. Like, you just start thinking from the perspective of this spirit or this plant, right? That's a mycelial network that connects everything, that, you know, sees and understands. And for those of you who don't know what a mycelial network is, underneath the ground, you know, what you see on top of the ground of a mushroom is like nothing compared to the huge giant network of almost what look like roots, right? That can span, there are some in Oregon that span entire forests, the mycelial root network, and they've actually discovered and found that these root networks connect all the roots of the trees and the plants, and that they can use them to transfer information and electrical signals from one tree to another. So for instance, if one tree is being attacked by some kind of a beetle infestation, it will electrically signal through the fungi and mycelial network, through this root network of the mushrooms, to the other ones, and they'll start producing this defense compound, right, in their trees. Or if one tree is sort of out of reach or not getting enough water or nutrients, they can actually shuttle nutrients also through the mycelial network from one tree to another that maybe has too many or plenty. So there's this perspective of just everything is connected and we're all connected. And so if that's the case, what's my perspective around any given thing, right? There's no us and them. There's only one of us here, right? We are a forest. So I was watching this police officer who was studying to be a psychedelic therapist and guide, and he was talking about how what it would look like to have heart-based policing, which is such a beautiful, beautiful concept or even idea. Like, I've never heard of somebody, like, what would it look like to police from the heart or heart-forward policing? And he was saying that the perspective or the paradigm of policing needs to change from police, right, which is rooted in control, right? And he said, what if instead of policing, what we were actually practicing was guardianship? If we were consider ourselves to be guardians of these communities and their safety and their well-being, and guardians of these people, right? What would shift in how we approach, how we teach policing, how we structure police around the way police interact with people? You know, he was talking about the layers and layers and layers of trauma on both sides. And it was, I was finding it very fascinating to just hear from somebody who's in their heart sort of what they see from the inside. And, you know, one of the things he was saying is that more police people die from their own guns than on the job or, you know, accidents or any other stuff. It's the number one cause of death for police people is suicide and people working in the police. And so that it's clear that there are deep levels of PTSD and deep levels of nervous system dysregulation. And as I was thinking about just this idea of, it's so easy to look at somebody like Derek Chauvin and be like, you're a bad person, right? Like, you're just a bad person. Like, we all saw the video, we all saw what happened, we all saw what you did. And it's so easy to go there and to not stop and think and consider what gets somebody to that point. What level of nervous system dysregulation, what level of PTSD, what level of abuse that person has to experience, as well as the levels of enabling and not being supported, not held accountable, right? Like, when someone doesn't see the people who hurt or punish them being held accountable for what they did to them, that wires itself into their nervous system, their memory core, their all those things, right? And that's when you get these people who are doing these heinous things in broad daylight. But that there's also so much more. It's just, it feels so lazy to be like, oh, he's just a bad person, right? We'll just throw him in jail. Because that's what we've been doing, right? We're like, oh, there are these people, and they're bad people, and so we just lock them in cages. And it's so not only dysregulating for the nervous system, but it's so damaging as a society, because it doesn't actually get to the root of the problem, right? It maybe temporarily stops that problem from fruiting out in the world, but it's not true safety in a society to have just hundreds of thousands of people locked in cages, right? Because when you let them out of the cages they've been locked in, and the trauma's deepened, and the survival mode is deepened, and they have less access to their prefrontal cortex, and they are working with even more, right? Their patterns are just going to be deepened, and they're going to come out. That's why we have such high recidivism rates. It's so funny that we call them correctional centers, but really they're more like dysfunctional centers. They create more dysfunction in society. We have these factories that are creating huge, wide-scale dysfunction in society. And, oh, it's so weird. I'm driving by a prison right now.
Oof.
Anyways, and so I think it's lazy to just say, oh, that person's a bad person, right? And it's not to say that we have to agree with what they did or even like hold compassionate space for them, or right? We get to have our own experiences around it and grieve and understand it. But if we are dedicated and committed to getting to the roots and to creating change, right? If we have a radical perspective of life, radical meaning the root, right? That's what radical means. It means coming from the root. When we look at what radical transformation looks like in society, we have to think about the roots of what's actually creating the problem. And so for me, this subconscious paradigm of people as being good or people as being bad is at the root of everything or much of what we are experiencing and seeing and witnessing in society today. It's what's beginning to break down. But again, the thing that gets tricky is when we fall into that paradigm as we're trying to heal, which many people wouldn't even describe what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to fight racism. They're trying to, you know, defeat it. They're anti-racists. They're anti-racism. There's no aspect where we're looking at this from a healing perspective, right? As a spiritual problem that's occurring that is actually like one of the things that in my mind I go on and on about with myself that I talk about a lot is like, I think it's important to acknowledge privilege. It's important to acknowledge the ways in which the society is set up to benefit some and not others financially and in terms of, you know, socially and our educations and, right? There's like so many systems of oppression, but I think it's also important to recognize and to start the conversation where we start looking at how this system is actually oppressive to everyone. Because until we see and understand that, that actually nobody's winning, right? When like white heteropatriarchy is running the world, we all lose. We all lose. Like, even the quote-unquote winners, what they're having to give up, what they're having to sacrifice, which in many cases is their own humanity, in order to quote-unquote win some material game, it ends up being such a far, far, far cost. Right? Like, I live in Asheville, and it's blowing up right now, and the city is, you know, the rents are going up and it's gentrifying and all this stuff. And we have such a huge homelessness crisis. We have such a huge drug epidemic that's occurring in the city. And we have so many people in and out of our jail system, in and out of our penitentiary systems. And so it's like our cities are less safe than they were, even though we're, quote unquote, materially progressing. Maybe that's what it looks like on the outside. It's like, you can't go into the town square because it's not safe into the center square. It's filled with people who are dealing with homelessness, who are really struggling, are in fight or flight, are not able to regulate their nervous systems, are not mentally well, aren't getting the services that they need to actually be able to show up and share their gifts with the community and live in their sacred purpose and offering, which enriches the world for everyone and the community for everyone, we're missing out on that. And so beginning to understand that we're actually all losing, because there's only one of us here, right? And so we're all losing when we're not creating a society that honors and attempts to maximize the human potential of every single person on the planet, or in that society, right? Or in that family, or whatever it may be, right? We miss out. Because who knows? Some of those people might be the next Einstein, the next Mother Teresa. They might, you know, like, be brilliant at science and technology. And it's like, we could imagine if those people we determined somewhere along the line, right? Like Einstein, oh, he's just bad. Throw him in a cage, let him rot. Let's not worry about what happens to him. All of the technology we would have lost, right? Anyone. And so there's all these sacred gifts and all these souls on sacred missions that have so much to contribute. And when we go into this good, bad thinking, we end up missing out on getting to the root of what's really going on in society, of what's really going on in a personal level with each person, and understanding why they're doing what they're doing. So talking about Derek Chauvin, it's like, you look at what he did, and it's so easy to go to the place where you're a bad person, right? And you deserve bad things, like very bad things to happen to you. And that line of thinking, taken to an extreme, simply becomes what he did to George Floyd, right? It has us desiring to put our needs on his neck. And so the cycle continues, right? And then somebody looks at us and doesn't understand what's going on with us, and how aggravated and agitated and traumatized or whatever it is, right? And then they put their knees on our necks, and it just continues. The energy in the cycle, right? So you can't fight racism, because racism is rooted in violence. It's rooted in this, in violence. And so the second you start to try to go to war on something to end violence, you're only going to create more violence. You're going to create more of the same energy of that level of consciousness, right? We have to get curious about these people who are violent and understand what the healing is that is needed, and work at that level if we're going to eradicate it from the root in a radical way and shift in a radical way. Like, my idea of justice is not that Derek Chauvin gets thrown in a cage somewhere and rots for the rest of his life. My idea of justice is that he gets the support, he and everybody, right? Everybody that goes through the system, would be that they get the support that they need, and then go out and make it their life mission to go help heal people who are dealing with the same things as them, right? My idea of justice is Derek Chauvin going out and becoming an anti-racism educator, right? Or a person whose goal is to heal racism in others and having an impact, right? That's really sort of the only way that we can... I mean, there is no way to even out what happened. That's not the language I want to use. But it's like, if we're looking at it from an energetic level, it's like, if he can go out and prevent that from happening 100 more times, that on a karmic level is a deep shift, is a powerful shift. And that, to me, is what I would want justice to look like. Not rooted in punishment. Because justice being rooted in punishment is what created what Derek Chauvin did. So we need to eradicate that idea. And it doesn't mean that there's no accountability. It doesn't mean It's just that the accountability looks different. Because Derek Chauvin being taken off the police force, yes. Not being trusted with any kind of power, yes. But being thrown in a jail cell and then left to rot seems like a waste of human potential. If there's a possibility that there's not only a healing that he can receive, but that he can actually give and transfer to others. And as somebody who's rooted and seen so many transformations through the work that I do, that I have done with myself and have seen other people do, it's like I know transformation is possible. So why aren't we leaning into that? Right? I get really... I don't even know what the right word is. Just passionate about this because it just... It feels like we're stuck in this karmic cycle, especially in this country. And the way we're trying to solve the problem is actually making the problem worse. And it's a tough pill to swallow, and it can feel very... And I get it. It can feel very insensitive, the way that I'm speaking with compassion for somebody who's done something that's so deeply traumatic to our country and to an individual and to a community. But we have to remember that that throwaway thinking, right, where we just throw people away, is what is part of rooted and creating racism. And so we have to notice and root that out and find that out at every angle if we're going to be able to heal it. Because this idea of like, well, we'll just, you know, racist people are bad and we're just going to throw them all away. It's like, we're all racist. So what are we going to do? Right? Is there no hope that people can change? And if there isn't, right, then why are we even in a movement of activism? We have no place in transformational activism movements if we don't believe that change is possible. And that kind of like leads me, or has me wind on to this next thing that I've been thinking about a lot, which is the languaging around patriarchy and how rooted actually all the language, and language is so fundamental because every thought we have is formed with language. So those are the building blocks of our reality. If our thoughts create our results, right, and our results create our reality that we live in, our thoughts are the building blocks. And what words we use are very important because every word is imbued with so much energy, so much energetic potential. Oh my gosh, I'm at exit 111 as I'm driving. That's wild. Magic. Been seeing angel numbers all day. The language that we use and the words that we use become our reality, and every word is rooted, and language is rooted in certain levels of consciousness, right? The easiest one that we all probably know is could versus should, right? I should run 5 miles today. Has such a different energetic experience in our body than I could run 5 miles today, right? One word shifts the entire paradigm. And when you're in that, I should run 5 miles today, you're often in some kind of a program, right? Should is like a core proponent of the program. It's like, this is what I should do, this is what I shouldn't do, right? It takes away our possibility. There's only, am I going to do what I should do or not do it and feel guilty and feel bad? Those are kind of our only options, is to do the thing or to suffer on some emotional level. When we shift into the possibility of could, we open up an infinite amount of possible modes of action that we can take on any given circumstance. And suddenly, the possibilities for the results that we can create in our life also become infinite. That's really where our power, one word, should versus could, can open up unlimited possibility. So the words that we're using are very important as we aim to shift and transform the world. We also have to transform the language. So much of, like, well, I want to separate this out because there's a sacred rage that is very important to honor, right? In all these conversations, there's a sacred rage, and part of what patriarchy does is it takes away anger psychically, right? It kind of programs the expression of anger out of women. And the way that I think about anger as an emotion is that it's there for two purposes, right? It tells me when I don't feel safe. It tells me when, you know, someone's crossing my boundaries or I'm in physical danger, right? Fight or flight, right? So I don't feel safe. When I feel a lot of anger coming up, I'm like, oh, I probably don't feel safe emotionally, physically, spiritually around someone. Oftentimes because they're probably doing something. Maybe I'm seeing them doing something to someone else. Maybe they're doing it to me, right? But it's like suddenly you get that anger that comes up is I don't feel safe. And so it's very important to honor that and restore that to the feminine, that sacred rage and that ability to say, hey, I don't feel safe. Let me go take the actions I need to, right? So I don't feel safe, or I'm not getting my needs met. That's the other time. And that usually shows up as resentment, or frustration, right? Like different flavors, sub flavors of anger. Or it can show up as rage, right? You see a lot of that in collective, like, protests, right? It's like, I'm not getting my needs met by this government or by this system or whatever it is. So it can also, express itself through the portal of sacred rage as well. So that's very important. And I want to honor that, and I think part of what we have to do is to create space for that sacred rage and get and be able to tap in and to use that anger as opposed to allowing it to use us and control us and dictate what we do. Because when the anger takes us over, all we can do is react, right? Not respond. And so we get put into this fight or flight state where we don't have access to our prefrontal cortex or to any of the different myriad of tools that we have on a normal day. And it just becomes solely like, I need to attack, hurt, or destroy this person or this thing or this concept, right? Who is, I feel I'm being threatened by, right? That is threatening me. And that level or that experience, while of course completely valid and understood, because all experiences are valid and understood, right? And that's really the core of, I think, creating radical change, is getting to the place where we can actually understand how and why things are operating so that we have a chance to work in a way that is transformational, radical, actually getting to the root of the problem, not just virtue signaling or changing our profile pictures or, you know, jumping on the bandwagon with everybody else. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with necessarily doing any of those things, but I don't think we're having the impact that we want to have. And that leads to a lot of the frustration and a lot of the feeling stuckness and a lot of the anger and the fear is that we feel impotent, right? We feel like we can't have an impact. We're not making an impact. We're not making progress. Things are going backwards. What's happening? And I think a lot of what, and this is, you know, who am I? I'm just like a funny little man who lives in the mountains. You know what I mean? In North Carolina. Like, what do I know, right? The truth is we're all wrong. But I'm trying to, one thing I try to keep my mind open to is constantly creating new theories. Because one of the things, one of my favorite thinkers says is like, the world is desperately in need of great ideas. And when there's a true lack of great ideas, what happens, especially in, let's say like an activism movement, what ends up happening is that your opponents define, first of all, you see them as opponents, right? Which is still this binary thinking of, oh, there's us and them, there's you against me, there's right against left, there's whatever. It's like there's the quote-unquote benefactors of the oppression and then the oppressed, where we fail to see that we're all being oppressed by the system. Some people are just getting quote-unquote more out of their oppression, but that the cost for all of us is far, far, far too high because it's our humanity, it's our soul, it's our spirit, right? And when we start acting in inhumane ways towards the earth and to one another, we are inevitably, right, denying ourselves of some level of humanity. Because it's not those who are oppressed who lose their humanity, it's those who do the oppressing, become inhumane. They're the ones who lose their humanity. And so that's far too great a cost. Far too great a cost. And so, coming back around to the point that I was trying to make, is the languaging is so important around patriarchy, because so much of it is reactive language, and it's language where our opponents are defining the ideas, right? And then we are just their loyal opposition. And again, I don't like this concept of opponents, but if we're going to start there, right, as a starting place, we see that we turn people into our opponents, and then they choose the playing field, and then we have to play on it. And it makes us feel impotent, it makes us feel powerless, it makes us feel frustrated. And if we want to step out into a new paradigm, if we actually want to create radical transformational change, we have to be the ones creating the ideas and then allowing everyone else to be in reactive to us, or hopefully in collaboration. Hopefully, the goal is, if we can see how we're all being oppressed by this system called patriarchy, how men have to psychically mutilate themselves and their energetic and emotional bodies in order to function in the world under patriarchy, right? Yes, they gain more money. Yes, they get to work and be in the C-suite. Yes, they get, you know, the big house. But what they lose is their actual experience of their own lives, of the ability to connect with other humans. It's a psychic isolation and a prison that men go through within patriarchy that drives them into this insanity, into this dominating, violent, predatory being, because they're so isolated and there's no way out. And when you step out of line as a man with what patriarchy expects of you, you can expect abuse. You can expect rejection, you can expect isolation, you can expect to lose the job or not get the job promotion or whatever it is, right? The level of gender policing that happens to men is so intense. Speaking only from my experience as a gay man, who, like, you know, once you opt into being gay, it's like you're kind of off the hook. Like, everyone's like, well, okay, right? Except for in the most extreme cases. But the very real, powerful, and subtle cues that are constantly being sent to straight men through media and, you know, all religion and all these other things, it psychically mutilates them in a way that is permanently psychologically damaging. And when we look at a lot of statistics, right? Mental illness in men, suicide rates in men. There's so many. There's literally like a laundry list of ways in which you can see this showing up. You begin to realize, oh, nobody wins in patriarchy. And that's my stance, because that's how we unite everybody. We we heal this illusion of opposition, right? I almost said destroy, but again, that's the language of patriarchy, right? We heal this illusion of opposition, and we realize that we're all here on this planet together to heal. And once we are able to attain that, once everybody's playing on the same team, oh my God, things get a lot easier, a lot faster. And so it's starting from that level of consciousness, right? We're all on the same team. What's best for me is also best for you, is best for everyone. And if it's not good for everyone, then it's probably not good for anyone, because there's only one of us here and we're all connected. Doesn't mean that everyone's gonna like what we choose to do, but sometimes we don't always like the things that are good for us, right? Sometimes it stirs things up in us, creates some certain level of resistance or trigger that can be a portal to healing. So just noticing the oppositional language, and I think a lot of it comes from the rumblings and the beginning of even feeling safe to express anger, right? Which is good, and that's healing, and we need that, and we need containers where specifically women and the feminine can express this anger and this rage in a uncontrolled way where they don't have to protect the people around them, and they're not, you know, worried, where they really can just let go and just be in the experience as a somatic release, right? Both individually and collectively. But I don't think staying there is how we get to the other side, per se. I think it's a step, and it's a step we might have to come back to often on this journey. I know my somatic releases with anger have been, I've talked about them here on the podcast, and they've been incredibly powerful and healing, and it's not the place where I've stayed in that fight or flight triggered state, because I don't feel like that's where I actually have access to my highest vision. And so as we're learning to wield this sacred rage, and the feminine is being invited back into being allowed to feel unsafe and voice that, and allowed to acknowledge that they have needs and voice that, I think there's a lot of space for the masculine to hold space for that and to be the space that can happen, that it's safe to do that. I think that's an incredibly powerful healing thing. And yet, when we're in this oppositional thinking, and men haven't been brought in and called in, and they are, there's many men that are, right? We might not be as in touch with them or know of those communities, but Sacred Sons is a very powerful community that's like that, of men who are being called into this work of just becoming safe spaces, right? Or first themselves. Because so often we aren't safe spaces for ourselves, and especially men who have never experienced what safe masculinity feels like, because masculinity has been defined through domination, has been defined through ownership, has been defined through, dare I say domination, through violence, right, and control. That's their relationship to themselves, and that's not a safe relationship. So if you don't have a safe relationship with yourself, you can't be a safe space for anybody else, right? And the ways in which patriarchy erodes the knowledge of a man's worth, his inherent worth, is so damaging to everyone, because it erodes his own security in himself. And insecure people are dangerous, right? I don't love the languaging around where my thinking is at around this, but I've been thinking lately about how insecure people are dangerous, because the second that their insecurity gets triggered, they're in a state of just trying to get back to security. So whether that means gossiping in the group and sharing, you know, details about someone else's life that they shouldn't because they felt insecure and they needed to get back to security, right? Or stealing a little bit of money or whatever it is, right? Insecure people are dangerous and unpredictable, perhaps, unreliable, not able to hold safe space for themselves, and therefore not able to hold safe space for others. And as the masculine, right, heals from patriarchy and learns to understand and come into right relationship with nature is a lot of it, right? So much of, I think, both sort of white delusion and patriarchal delusion, and I think that they very much go hand in hand, comes from being split from the earth and being confused about what our relationship to the earth is. That's a very deep spiritual wound. It's one that I feel like I'm going on a journey right now to heal. Because I don't feel like I have a home. I don't feel like any land is my land. Unless I own it, right? But I don't have a feeling that I belong to certain land. I've been brainwashed with the idea that the land belongs to me. And so I've never cultivated this deeper relationship with nature where I feel situated and located and secure in that relationship. I've never cultivated a relationship with nature. I lived in New York for 10 years. So, New York City. So, knowing that that also plays into it, but that the root of healing patriarchy in the male psyche really comes down to restoring his own security in himself so that he can then stand up and be a safe space in the world and be an energy of safety in the world. That's what I think a lot about, like, lately in the past 3 months. I've really been deepening into, I've been very, like, called, which has been so funny, to go on this, like, journey into the masculine heart and this journey into manhood, right? And when I say that, I have an interesting perspective as a queer male, because I don't think the journey into manhood necessarily is predicated on any kind of physical, biological, gender expression, any of that, right? I think the journey into manhood is the journey of becoming that safe space. And anybody can go on it. And I was talking about this with one of my friends, and we were really dissecting it. And, you know, it's like the energy of being a protector. Because the thing that everybody's freaked out about, right, with all these shifts and all this energy coming up and, you know, the way in which the sacred feminine rage is starting to be channeled, but then there's still some reactivity into it. And so it pushes against that masculine insecurity, that wound that hasn't been healed, and then that drives the masculine to become dangerous, right? It's threatened, it's insecure. And so we have to work at the level, oftentimes, of, in my mind, the problem in order to be safe ourselves. And while we must look inside ourselves and do our own work, I think it's important to understand and realize and hold space for, oh, like when the masculine is healed, suddenly the masculine becomes a safe space. It becomes a protector, a protective energy, right? In the sense of, oh, like, if the masculine is no longer a danger or a threat, then the feminine is free to just go do what it wants to do and not have to worry about the danger, right? It's like the way the masculine becomes a safe space is becoming a safe space for themselves and finding security and not being threatened constantly. And that creates the safety for the feminine to not have to defend and take care of all the shit that the masculine is creating and have to deal with all that shit. And then the feminine's free to just be and explore and create, right? Much in the same way that, you know, if we are looking at policing in this country, right, and the way it works and the way people are trained and the way people are taught to think and racism and its role, and, you know, we have to look at the PTSD that these officers face that are having them take these egregiously violent and uncalled for and unnecessary actions. Because until that's healed, the problem's just gonna keep replicating itself. The trauma's just gonna keep occurring. And so it's not to center the masculine or males, and it's not to center whiteness in this conversation around racism. But we do have to center the problem. And I think if you're in the activism space, and listen, I don't know if I consider myself an activist per se, but I definitely think very deeply on these topics, and I try to look at any problem from multiple perspectives and see what I might be able to understand more deeply about myself in my work. Because that's what I'm really deeply committed to, and that's where it's kind of naturally led me to in my life right now, is just wanting to understand these systems more deeply and how we heal them, both on a personal level in myself, but the personal is collective and the collective is personal. So it inevitably becomes a larger conversation. This is where my journey has led me, and this is kind of where I'm at, is into having these larger conversations with myself. Because I'm in a space where I can hold space for that, right? There's like, I've gotten to a level of security with myself and in my business and in what I'm up to creating and in empowerment, where I start to see my impact as being a lot larger than I used to. And so I start thinking bigger thoughts and solving bigger problems and bringing this conversation onto these topics. For me, it's a way to work through my own healing, but it also feels like a way in which I can offer something, you know, just a perspective. It's not the truth, right? The truth is we're all wrong. We're so ignorant. And if you think you're right, like, you're already behind, right? You've already closed your mind to 1,000 different possibilities. And so I don't pretend to be right. I don't pretend to be a source of truth. I am just a person who is exploring and trying to learn as much as I can and sharing that exploration with people. But coming back around to what I was saying, we have to center on some level, we have to center what the actual problem is. Because if you've got a leak and you just keep putting a bucket under the leak and trying to deal with it that way, but you never heal the leak, the leak never ends. The pain never ends. And so in this analogy, right, if the pain of racism is due to the programming that's occurring in white people's minds and nervous systems, right, and in the case of the police force, the levels of PTSD that these officers are facing, then that gets to be a main part. I feel like it has to be a main part of the conversation, because otherwise we just go, oh, well, they're just bad people. And then we don't have to look at ourselves. We don't have to root out these systems within us. We don't have to do the work of finding our way back into love, of creating a paradigm of healing, because America's a racist country. So if you're born in America, you're also racist. And when we can let go of the value judgment around that and the shame around it, and create safe spaces for people to work through the guilt, the shame, the pain that comes with seeing how you've unintentionally hurt people, then we create a way for the nervous system to move through that, because there is a trauma of being an oppressor, right? Whoa, now we're really getting crazy, right? There's a trauma that has to occur on some level, because trauma, untraumatized people, right? Healthy, whole, happy people don't oppress others. They heal and they liberate them. So if we are operating on some level of oppressing others, it's because we are being oppressed. And there's inherent trauma in that. And there's inherent trauma in also waking up to realize the pain and the damage that we've caused. And that is another area that I get curious about, is in the folks who are doing the work with white folks, right? Are there enough spaces, or is this even a conversation that's being talked about, where people are able to work through and heal that in themselves? Because that's what keeps people from facing it, right? Is the shame, and is the of facing that trauma, right? Or are we just having conversations about white fragility, and then it ends there, and it's bad people, and it's whiteness as death, right? I'm not saying that white fragility doesn't act within the realms and the paradigms of racism to reinforce it. And I think the conversation that we need to look at again there is, how do we heal it? How do we heal that white fragility? Right? Rather than judging it, calling it bad, how do we heal it? How do we move through it? How do we create space for that to process through? Because if we can't do that, then we're just stuck. And the white people are fragile. They can't handle these conversations. And then the conversation doesn't happen. And both sides feel frustrated and feel angry. And that's the thing that we get to realize, is they're like, we're all on one team. Like, as long as we're seeing that there are sides, we're in a paradigm of opposition, we're in a paradigm of fight, we're in a paradigm of us and them, we're in a paradigm of othering, that is the root of this separation, is the root of the wound. That level of consciousness and that thinking is baked into, you're different from me, you're other, I'm against you. That's at the core of racism. So we have to find ways, without bypassing, right, asterisk, 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 underline, highlight, without bypassing the work and the roles that we've all played, and the way it has played out oppositionally, and the ways we have taken sides, right? It's not like, oh, kumbaya, and then we're all just one, and we don't have anything to look at. It's like, no, we create this paradigm so that we can all look at the separation that has been caused more deeply and take ownership for it more deeply. And play for all people to win, not just some people to win. Because as soon as you enter the win-lose agreement, you're in the fundamental agreement of racism and patriarchy and all forms of oppression. It's a win-lose agreement. In order for me to win, you have to lose. So we create games. If you look, oh man, I talk about this all the time, but if you look at the way that winning works, the paradigm of winning that exists in at least the Western world, we see that the fundamental way, the only way to win anything, a golf tournament, a basketball game, right, video game competition, the only way to win is to make everyone else lose. The only way to win is to make everyone else lose. So when that's baked into your subconscious psyche, and you start tramping around the world saying, I want to be a winner, I want to succeed. In the back of your mind is a subconscious belief that in order for me to win, everyone else has to lose. And that is what you play out. That is what gets created. And when we look at all of our systems, they're all created in that agreement. You look at our economic system, you look at our education systems, you look at sports, you look at, right? And so it ends up becoming this really silly thing we do where we spend all of our time trying to make everybody else lose so that we can win, not realizing we're all on the fucking same team. It's like a soccer team where everybody's playing against each other. And so nobody's scoring any goals. As opposed to, oh, like, just imagine for a second if soccer, there was no opposing teams. It was just everybody on the field wanted to get the ball in the net as much as possible. You could have 900 goals, 2,000 goals, right? And so the thing that happens is when you leave the win-lose, right, which is, you know, I don't watch enough soccer to know how many points people usually get, but I don't think it's many. It's like 3 to 5, maybe, usually. I don't know. Imagine going from 3 to 5 goals to suddenly like 2,000 in an hour. That's what happens when we leave the win-lose agreement and we enter into the win-win agreement. Suddenly the goals we start to pursue are so much bigger and we can accomplish so much more because everybody's on the same team. Nobody's running interference. Nobody's opposition. Nobody's the person we have to take down. Nobody's the enemy. We're all called in to work towards a common goal. And so if you let politics divide you, if you let this win-lose consciousness pervade whatever it is you're up to creating, you're gonna, the best it ever gets is 3 to 5, maybe 6 goals. But the reality is it could be 2,000, or at a certain point, it would be like, oh, this is so silly. Why are we even trying to get this ball in the net? There's 50 people here. We're all working on the same team. Why don't we, like, go solve world hunger? Right? It gets bigger. What you begin to see as possible with your power. And so that's really where our power resides, in my belief, is to call people into being on the same team. As long as we are fractioning ourselves or seeing it as an us and them, seeing it as a win-lose, we have lost access to so much power and creating allies and being able to explain these things, right? Starting with the belief that all systems of oppression are inherently oppressive to everyone, obviously not at the same levels, and we're not trying to say, oh, racism is worse for white people than it is for black people, right? It's like, that's so not, I mean, I trust the people that listen to this podcast to understand what I mean and not be idiots about it, right? Or use it in a way that, like, undermines or gaslights or, like, bypasses, right? That's not the work that I'm up to in the world, and hopefully it's not the work you're up to either. But if it is, that's okay, because it's, we all start somewhere, right? And then we learn. And you're not wrong for that. We've all done it at some point. It's just part of the journey of expanding our consciousness. But my hope is that people take this and they use it as an invitation to begin finding ways in both their minds and their hearts to call other people in and access more of their power to impact and create change by creating one global team and a unified mission where no one's running interference. And if we can start viewing these systems of oppression through the lens of how they actually rob all of us, there's actually something better that is possible for every human being on the planet when we heal homophobia, right? Not just queer people, right? I think, honestly, straight men, straight white cis men, have the most to gain from, well, I'll take that back. Have so much more than they realize to gain from healing homophobia in society. because they are so constantly and endlessly gender policed and not allowed to self-actualize or express or be human, and they don't even realize it, because one of the ways that patriarchy replicates itself is one of the ways that you gain status as a male within patriarchal culture is by policing other people's gender. That's one of the ways you stay safe. That's one of the ways that you assert dominance and control, is through this policing, right? Calling out, oh, that's a girl behavior, oh, you're saying like a girl, or oh, that's so gay, bro, or oh, you know, you can't wear those pink shoes, or oh, whatever it is. And so it's a protection strategy in many ways. But they don't realize what's available to them on the other side of healing homophobia in society. And I don't think we do either. And I don't think we spend enough time. I don't think I personally have spent enough time grieving the wounds of the male heart under patriarchy. And thinking about that. And you know what's cool is, as I've been getting this work, I've been around a lot of straight men who are doing this work and seeing them, right? They're in states and spaces being held by other men that are safe enough for them to bring these pieces of themselves back online, and they're so wounded. They're so fucking wounded. And so we all get to heal. And what's on the other side of that is so fucking, you know, that's like the 9,000 goals instead of the 3. It's like, what's on the other side of us all healing is so much bigger and more beautiful than anything anybody's getting out of any system of oppression today. And I think helping people to wake up to that and believe and see and trust in that future is one of the most powerful things that we can do in the world at this time. That's my opinion. That's my current theory about it. But I was saying that I was, I've been thinking a lot about masculinity and just what it is, and the journey of manhood, right? And that I was talking to a friend, I'll come back to this story, I was talking to a friend who went on the journey of becoming a man, to becoming a man, when she was 6 years old. And her dad went to lunge at and attack her little brother, and she like stepped in the way, right? And she was like, I'm gonna call the police if you touch him. Right? At 6 years old. This protection energy. And that does something strange to the energy fields of the being. When you're forced to go on the journey of manhood, A, unconsensually, right? But B, at such a young age, like just, I'm just thinking of the energy body of this 6-year-old girl who suddenly has to go through the journey of manhood at the age of 6. And it's like, ooh, it's a shape that energy isn't supposed to be in yet, right? It doesn't even choose to go on that journey. So the point of that is to suffice to say that, you know, the journey of manhood has nothing to do, it's like an energetic frequency that you hold of you're in the space and the space feels safer. And you're so secure and safe and stable with yourself that when other people are experiencing insecurity, are wobbling, are energetically not balanced or stable or dysregulated, you're able to hold and anchor that frequency so deeply that you help to rebalance them, right? I think that's, and we all have the divine masculine and we all have the divine feminine within us in equal portions. That is just true, and it's so important for us to balance those two energies in ourselves. But there are some people who will choose on their spiritual path to embody and anchor in and learn how to hold certain frequencies as medicine, right? One of mine is goofiness. It's one that I play around with all the time. It's like I very much feel that a frequency that I'm meant to hold and do this work with is just like being a jester, making it laugh, making it lighthearted, letting it be fun, bringing joy, right? So that's one frequency that I work on a lot. And I've even thought about going to comedy school or like learning how to do stand up and just augmenting that frequency, right? And like maybe going on the journey to comichood, right? And becoming a comic, at a higher level. And so the journey to manhood is the same. It's a frequency. And if you feel called to go on that journey and hold that frequency, then that's something that's available to you, to anyone. And the thing that's so interesting about, that I have been thinking a lot about is, let me drink some water. I'm recording this as I drive from Ohio to, back to Asheville, back home, just because I've been having all these thoughts for like 3 months, and I'm the kind of person that can't sit down and write out all my thoughts in like a coherent way. Because I just get bored. Well, what happens is then I start having more thoughts. And then it ends up being a 45-page booklet of thoughts that really don't make any sense. It's like when I'm trying to organize the information, it gets less organized. So I'm like, whoa, right? Like you, it's like Hydra, you cut off one head and seven grow. It's like I write down one idea that I like want to talk about, and then like 12 more come up, and I'm like, uh-oh. So lately I've just been practicing like hitting record or going live or hosting a workshop and just like letting whatever's going to come through me and getting these ideas out into the world. Because if I'm trying to polish them and make them make sense and say it in a superstructure, it's just not how it works for me. That's just not. So not how it works. So we're learning how it works, which is fun. But so much of sort of what one line of thinking around the masculine, right? So there's this tussle that's happening energetically between the masculine and the feminine, and the masculine's feeling very insecure, and they're feeling like masculinity needs to be protected, and masculinity is under attack. Is the languaging that I've heard be used around, you know, some people on the far right, or not even on the far right, right? I just hear that kind of sometimes in men's circles or whatever. And I think that's a really silly idea to me with my current level of understanding about masculinity or the energetics of a masculine frequency. Is what I find silly about it is like, masculinity doesn't need protecting. Masculinity is protection. It's like, it is the energy of safety. So it's really so funny, like, if something can be threatened, then it's not masculine energy. Like, because masculine energy is the energy of safety, of being that anchor, of being that solid principle, of being just that, that energetic refuge, right? And so whatever they're feeling is being threatened is not masculinity, is my point, is my thought right now. I'm like, if it can be threatened, it's not masculine, right? It's not masculinity that's being threatened, it's something else. And, you know, with the shootings that have been occurring, and specifically, like, I went on a medicine journey, and I connected, and this always seems to happen for me, is, like, I, in any kind of a tragedy, my energy tends to connect with the person who's at fault or at blame. And I don't know why this is, but I just, that's who I tend to connect to energetically, and where my mind goes, I think. Partially because I want to understand, right? If I'm not believing that there are just some bad people and whatever, and it's random and there's nothing we can do, and right? Then I'm like, why? What were you experiencing? How much suffering were you experiencing in your life that you had to do that? Or that you felt that that was the only way that people could understand how much pain you were in, right? And so I connected on this medicine journey to, sort of, it felt like I was inside his mind and experiencing what he was experiencing as he was doing that. Listen, y'all, psychedelics are not for the faint of heart. And there's no words to describe it. There's really isn't. And I think that's why he did what he did, because it was so, it was a suffering that, it was demonic in nature. I believe that when suffering gets to such a deep festering, insane point, it becomes the energy, almost becomes like an entity, right? The energy of suffering. And that pain becomes almost like an energetic entity that is demonic in nature. And I think demons are just energetic entities that are suffering on such a deep level that everything they come into contact with, they create suffering, right? Because we know that hurt people hurt people. And when we're really located in our suffering, often we go out and we create more suffering in the world. And so this, like, kind of energy, like the energetics of demons, I've been, like, I know this sounds crazy, but I'm just like, what if demons aren't bad? We've been taught to fear them. We've been taught to banish them. We've been taught to, right, like, be very afraid of demons. And I'm like, what if demons are literally just entities that are in so much deep suffering that they cause unspeakable amounts of tragedy and trauma in the other entities around them that they meet, until they meet an entity that is able to love them and see them and not judge them, but is able to understand them on such a deep, powerful level that it transforms and allows them to heal. Like, what if demons don't need to be destroyed? What if they need to be not loved in the sense of worshipped or revered, but what if they need to be healed and met with such a powerful love that that suffering evaporates and they're restored into their energetic integrity? So I was connected, or I was connecting and connected to what he was experiencing while he was committing the atrocity that he did. And it, well, I mean, it's, no words, but it was like this demonic level of suffering and darkness and pain, and just, I just like wept and wept and wept for his pain. Another thing that's interesting that's just coming to my mind right now is how often we feel like in order to, like, we have to take sides always, right? There's always this oppositional thinking that, like, if somehow I'm having compassion for him, I'm not having compassion for the victims and their families, right? Or I'm somehow invalidating it, which, you know, I don't think has to be true. I don't think compassion is a zero-sum game. I don't think we have to choose sides. I think there's the ability to, right? And compassion also does not mean, sometimes people make it this really frilly word of, like, as if we're going to have compassion for someone and then we're just going to let them have no accountability, or we're just going to let them do whatever they want or cross our boundaries or whatever. That's not compassion. That's actually deeply uncompassionate for everyone involved, right? Compassion is a very difficult practice, and it requires you to stand up and say things and speak truths, and, like, sometimes compassion is like an ass kick, right? It's like speaking the truth. That's sometimes, like, speaking a truth that will dissolve everything, right? Maybe it's a relationship. It can be the most compassionate thing to do, but that doesn't mean it's the least painful. I think sometimes people conflate compassion with, like, feeling good or feeling loving or not feeling fear. That's not, compassion is like the path of a warrior and a healer, right? And somebody who's willing to face the things inside of them and meet it with love so that they can do that to those who are outside of them. But deepening into what I'm bringing up about being able to hold space and understand the suffering that happens, and also understand that, you know, if somebody who had a family member or a child heard me speaking on this podcast in this way, I would also have compassion and understanding for them not be being able or being very triggered or being very upset at my thinking and compassion for this person who has hurt them in the most probably unimaginable, probably one of the most traumatic and unimaginable ways humanly possible to hurt another being, which is to kill their child. I would totally get that too, right? And so we all have our processes and how we're moving through any experience. And I've had moments of experiencing something at the hands of someone and not being able to access compassion and needing to work through what I needed to work through before I got there. So I get it, right? But I was thinking about this tragedy, and I was thinking about guns. And as I was dropping even deeper into the energetics of gun ownership and why there are so many people who are terrified, like, I was like, gun violence is a tragedy in this country. A tragedy. And doesn't matter what side you're on, it's a tragedy. But what I also find to be tragic is that there are so many people in this country who feel so afraid in their day-to-day lives and so unsafe that the only way they can feel safe out in the world is by having a gun with them. And then the thought of somebody taking their gun away is terrifying. That is a tragedy. That is the conversation I want to have and what I want to look at and understand. Because that's a trauma response. And I think it's a collective, long-standing, centuries-long trauma response in our country that's been passed down epigenetically from the war and from what happened with the white folks who came here and the colonizers that came here and the religious persecution that they were fleeing and their need to use arms to overthrow oppression that was put on them and why it was enshrined, right? Like that trauma of that war between the colonies and England is enshrined in our Constitution. And I think it's why the United States has such a crazy fucking relationship with guns, because we're one of the few countries, we're such a young country, that our country was born around a similar time. I mean, I don't know the timelines, right? So this could be off, but it's like it was formed around the same time as guns, and guns were already on the scene. So of course there's conversations around it, and if you only survived and were able to gather your own independence and overthrow tyranny, your experience of tyranny, right? Because it's like the oppressed always become the oppressors, right? And it just is an endless cycle. Then of course you're gonna say, no, I fucking need my gun. I'm not safe without it. And that's where we are as a country. And so the sadness that came to my heart during that ceremony and that I realized is there's so much collective trauma. Oh, hold on, somebody is driving unsafely. Okay, he's going like 90 miles. That's out of control. But thank you for cleaning out all the cops for me. Hopefully, if there are any cops, they will pull you over, not me. Anyways, it's a good example of someone who's thinking. Hopefully, you will start to drive more safely. Without having to experience negative consequences first for you or others. And hopefully you get wherever you're going in one piece and on time. Anyways, guns in this country they're like a symbol. It's symbolic for people. And it symbolizes their safety, and it's so sad to me. I think a lot of times when I think about our relationship between authority and people who are authorized, are authoritative at, right? Like, if I look at my relationship to authority, the primary relationship for most of us that forms and develops our relationship to authority for the rest of our lives is going to be one of three. It starts with our parents, right? Mother and father. And from there we learn, like, authority disciplines me, authority controls me, authority doesn't have my best interests at heart, or the people in authority care deeply for me, and they look out for me, and they have a higher perspective, and they listen to me, and they're, you know, on my side, and I feel connected and safer around them, right? So it's that, it's school, and then it's religion, and the religious community you grew up in. And so those three things, but usually I think about it through the lens of parents, because it's just easier,
right?
An easier proxy. And it defines our relationship with authority in a way that relationship then begins to be projected, and that's how we understand authority and then relate to it in every other context in our life, regardless of if that person holds authority or wields authority in the same way that our parents did. The lessons we learned and the beliefs we created about the authorities in our lives those first years are wired into us until we do some deep digging and reprogramming. And so I thought, wow, if the government is kind of proxy for parents, right? Imagine having a relationship with your parents where you don't feel safe unless you have a gun with you. And imagine how abusive that relationship would have to be, or had been. And imagine how scary it must be to live in a world where you don't feel safe around your parents unless you not just have one gun, but as many guns as you would want. But that's the only way to feel safe around your parents, is to have a gun when you're near them. And it made me really sad. I, like, cried for, like, 20 minutes. Just at the collective wounding and the fear that people have and hold around guns, and how tied in that is, like, gun culture. I think it's very easy to just be like, oh, they're hicks, or they're idiots, or they're propagandized, or whatever. It all starts in your nervous system. This is what I'm, like, realizing. Deep beliefs and stuff, they all happen in the nervous system, and it's not feeling safe. Like, I want a world in which the idea of having a gun is just insane, because what would you even need it for? It's extraneous, it's ridiculous. It's like the way we would think about somebody having a nuclear weapon. It's like, that's so overkill and crazy and weird, and like, why would you ever need a nuclear weapon that could wipe out 8 million people, one person, right? Why would you ever need that? And that's, we create a reality where it is so safe that then becomes the experience of, like, whoa, that's overkill. But the thing about guns and gun culture is that it creates less safety. And so when there is less safety, when people are storming into schools and shooting small children all over the country, these are not isolated incidents. These are systemic, repeated, daily occurrences. More children die every year from gun violence than any other cause of death in the United States. This is a collective trauma and tragedy that we're experiencing, when the only way that the people who feel so already so unsafe, the only way they know how to get their safety is through guns. That's when you see this, like, gun culture on steroids. It's like, okay, well, now I don't just need a gun to feel safe. I need 2 guns or an open carry permit or a rifle or a sniping gun, or I need to be able to have this, like, automatic ammunition. I need to, right? It's like, it's just a patterned response of, like, guns are the things that make me feel safe. The more guns I have, the more safe I feel. Please don't take away my guns. I'm going to go into a trauma response. And so it would not surprise me if there is strong gun legislation that starts being passed, but we don't clear this up and clean up this trauma in the collective first. It would not surprise me if those people go into such fight or flight, right? And that's gun owners choose fight, right? That's their go-to. It would not surprise me at all if they attack. And there's already hundreds of militias all around the United States that are actively training. This is a scary thing to talk about sometimes. But there's hundreds of independent militias that are training. Some of them, many of them have ties to white supremacist groups. Some of them are cults. Some of them pretend to be religious communities. Some of them, you know, you name it, right? You got it all. But there's hundreds, multiple in each state, of these independent militias. It could be 100 people, 200 people, 300 people that are training. For what? That's not entirely clear always. But they're ready and prepared for battle and combat. And I believe that if we go into a civil war, which I believe that is so within the realm of possibility with the level of polarity and the level of topical, first of all, just awful leadership in this country, just a lack of any integrity and topical solutions, and just we've devolved into not having deep, powerful, meaningful conversations about the radical roots of problems, how to solve them. It's turned into this Twitter shit show of people calling each other names and posting bad pictures and slandering and gossip, and it's just like, it's lost to me any and all integrity whatsoever. The way that the politicians are holding themselves in this country and the level of discourse that we're having is, some reality TV shows, it's the fucking Real Housewives of the United States government. It's like trash TV to me. And that's really all it is it's just trash TV, it's media, it's marketing. We're not deeply, or there are very few people who I feel are very deeply working. And it's so seductive because it's the way to get the views, it's the way to get the platform, it's the way to get, you know, the way in which our politics is running. Like, our political system was not made in a time of social media. So the things that are happening, or even, you know what I mean? It's just like, oof, we really need to figure some shit out and have some deep conversations and do some soul searching as a country. Figure out where we're moving and how to heal. But anyways, that lack of leadership in the United States, I think, contributes to also us not feeling safe with our quote-unquote parents. And so you have all of these people who are military trained, and I think if we head towards a civil war, which I think, you know, if something were to radically pass and remove all the gun rights in America, or dramatically impede them, I think you would start beginning to have, like, even more domestic terrorism, even more guerrilla attacks, but I think these militaries would start mobilizing. And that's why when we're looking at policy change, you can't just change your policy, you have to change your culture. Right? You have to go to the root. Because I moved to South Africa, I lived in South Africa when I was 16, and they had only ended segregation, apartheid, 12 years before I got there. Right? 12 years before that there had been this huge long history of just complete segregation, different schools, different everything. Nobody's hearts and minds were changed. Everybody still had the same opinions. Everybody was still so fucking blatantly, insanely, absurdly racist in South Africa. It was the most shocking thing to me as a little 16-year-old who was, like, you know, still very naive and ignorant and, you know, grew up in sort of this little blissful bubble of white privilege where I'm like, oh, you know, America's, you know, not so racist or da-da-da-da-da, right? And it's just, like, at the time, too, those conversations weren't being had on a wide-level scale. We're being taught in schools. So it's just, like, when you're 16, you don't necessarily have access to those levels of conversations. But going to South Africa, it fucking blew my shit open. And I was like, whoa. Like, just because you change a lot does not mean you change the hearts or the minds of anybody. And if anything, a lot of people dig their heels in. A lot of people feel that their opinion or their viewpoint is now being suppressed. And that energy of I'm being suppressed, I'm being silenced, which, you know, we've seen that coming up a lot on both sides, right, with COVID, is very dangerous because oftentimes, I believe, like, terrorism is the scream of the unheard. It's the scream of the unheard, of the ignored, of those who feel like they have no other discourse to get attention to their cause. It's like, if you listen to these things and heal with them and work with them, I love this. I always say this in coaching. It's like, if you deal with something when it's a whisper, it never becomes a scream. And if we simply do this topically and we never treat the root cause, all we're doing is covering that festering wound over, and that fear and that scarcity, right, and that trauma, we're just covering it over with some skin like a wound, and then it's just gonna fester and infect the whole thing, and it's gonna start exploding, right, in all the other aspects of the body system, right, when there's an infection. Kidneys start to fail, the eyesight starts to fail, you know, you get sick. It's like the violence will start to erupt in all these different places because we haven't treated it at the root. And so you take people's guns away, but they're still traumatized and terrified, and they're gonna fight for their fucking guns because that's the only thing that makes them feel safe. And so they're fighting for freedom, but really what they're fighting for is their, in their minds, is their own safety, right? And this is all subconscious. I don't think people are necessarily aware, so to speak, of all of this on either side. And so it then becomes this antecedent or this antagonistic. It's like you create a bigger problem. You don't solve it. The gun violence gets worse because you don't solve it at the root. You try to solve it topically. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to say about masculinity, because I've been thinking about it a lot, and then maybe I'll record something else about it. But I think the main thing that I took away from my understanding around, oh, that the journey into manhood is only you can do it, but you can't do it alone. Like, only you can do it, but you cannot do it alone. And I think that's why it's so important to have others who are on that journey with you, holding you and being that anchor and showing you how to embody with any kind of, like, vibrational or frequency energetics. Like, anytime we're trying to channel certain vibrations onto the planet, it's so important that we have others around us who can be tuning forks and who we can use to resonate with and just learn from being in their vibration and embody their energetic sphere, just to help us bring us back, to help us watch what it looks like in action, right? It's like people tell the story of Jesus all the time, not necessarily what he said, but what he did in the energetics, and they learn from his example, and he's a primary example of the embodiment of love in the world, what that looks like, what that means to people. And so I think for me, my journey into manhood is like getting myself in spaces with men who are not just doing this work, but have been doing this work and who anchor in. And, you know, there's a couple really powerful men that I know who've been doing this work for a long time. And one of them I met at Burning Man a couple of years ago. And I met this dude, and it's like, it was the wildest experience. At first, I just assumed he was gay because I hadn't done any very much healing work at all yet, and was really kind of even newer to my coaching work, and it just really hadn't gotten there. But I felt so safe around him, and I felt so immediately connected and intimate with him that I just assumed he was gay. He's beautiful, too. So I was like, oh my God, marry me. And then I found out later he was straight, and it was like the most mind-confuddling experience that I've ever had, because I felt so safe around him, like safer than I've even felt around most gay men or even women. I was like, I feel so safe around you and so just seen and expressed and loved and connected. And you're straight, dude. Like, what is that? How does that even work? And I uncovered a lot of trauma in that experience, and at Burning Man in specific, because many of the men at Burning Man, not all of them, right? It's 80,000 people, so it's a grab bag. But in the community that I camped with at Burning Man, which is it's like a lot of people who are really doing their work. Very cool community to be a part of. The men are very physically expressed and affectionate with each other and with themselves, and, you know, just the way they dress, and there's, you know, guys wearing skirts and, you know, makeup or painting their nails or doing whatever they want to do, and, like, you know, having their heads on each other's laps or holding hands or all this stuff that's, like, you just immediately, like, my mind goes just immediately assuming they're gay, right? And being in spaces with straight men, and then when they would touch me, then they would hug me, when they put their arm around me, I would immediately recoil and feel my whole body freeze, like go into fight or flight. And I realized that it's because I've spent my whole life working so hard to make straight men feel safe around me, of seeing myself as a potential trigger or threat to a straight man and his safety, and not having examples of straight men who have been on the journey to manhood, right? But have this wimpy, distorted version of masculinity that is so easily threatened, right? Which, again, that's not masculinity. That it really was wild what my body did, because my whole body would freeze up, and I was so terrified that they were going to hit me. And I wasn't even touching them. They were putting their arms around me. They were giving me a hug. They were, you know, whatever, you know? Normal stuff that I would do with any female, but that, to me, it felt so dangerous. And I realized, like, I've spent my whole life, like, making sure I don't look at straight men for too long, making sure that I'm not, you know, acting too gay, or that I'm, like, nothing that I'm doing could be misconstrued, or if I'm in a locker room, it's like I'm so overly, like, making sure I'm not looking at anybody else, or even looking around. I'm always looking at the ground so that nobody could ever accuse me of, you know, anything or get aggressive or violent with me. And that, in so many ways, I think has shaped my whole perception of the masculine. And so that started to break down at Burning Man, and it's the first time I really saw how much wounding I had around the masculine, and how much trauma I was holding in my body around it, and how much fear, right? And I've never been successfully physically attacked, we'll put it that way, for my sexuality. But I think that there's just something you learn growing up queer of how to survive. And you just, especially if you're like energetically sensitive, you learn these things. And then when somebody else breaks them, especially a straight man, it's like, oh, no, we're doing something wrong. We're doing something you shouldn't do. We're doing something that's not safe. It's not safe for me to touch a straight man, right? Because he could misconstrue that as a sexual advance, and then things could get really gnarly really quickly. So there's just so much healing that happened for me around that. But being around, you know, brothers who hold this frequency for me has been really transformative and life-changing. And for me, it feels like that's how this journey goes. Like the journey into manhood and the masculine heart and me being able to hold this frequency of the divine masculine even deeper is like, I'm the only one who can do it, this journey, right? The only one who can do it is me, and I can't do it alone. And I think that is very important. And then the last thing I'll say is that I think the paradigm of masculinity, I don't even want to call it a paradigm, because it just, to me, it sort of feels like there's this, I don't want to call it a true masculinity, but there's something that feels resonant with the energy of how I express it. And of course, you know, all energies are evolving, but you know, one of the beautiful things about doing this work with Sacred Sons is that they're so open to you defining masculinity for yourself and what that means and being on your journey with it and just being called deeper and allowing spirit to really, them not imposing masculinity on you, because the true masculine doesn't impose, it holds space, doesn't put anything on, it allows for greater unfolding and expanding of what's truly within you, which is so beautiful. It's so healing to be in a space like that. I don't know if I'd ever really truly been in a space that was held to that level of energetic container, and it's something I really strive for and want to create even more of in my containers. Of like, that's part of why I feel so called to do this work, is to be the deeper embodiment of that energy on the planet and also in the coaching industry. I think there's a very distorted, misaligned version of what masculinity is that's being carried by a lot of women, which isn't a bad thing, but it's not necessarily a conscious choice of holding this distorted version of masculinity and way of doing things and using that in a way that's A, unbalanced with the feminine, but B, might not actually be the journey they want to be on. They just have seen other women holding that frequency and teaching them and embodying that, and so they're tuned to that to think, oh, if I want to be a $10 million coach, if I want to be a $50 million coach, whatever, I have to hold this energy field. And again, it's that weird journey into manhood that's not totally consensual. So, anyways, I really would love to create spaces in the coaching industry where that energetic is held so powerfully of this masculine energy that is the energy of safety, that the true expression or the true embodiment is able to be found. Because I feel like that distorted or misaligned version of masculinity comes from, it's almost like a trauma response. It's almost like it's a coping mechanism, right? And so until it's held in a safe way, it's really hard to dissolve it. And I think that's the most important thing we have to realize about trauma, is it like needs to be held in safety for it to transmute and alchemize. And punishment is not safety. Accountability creates safety, but punishment doesn't, and judgment doesn't. And this kind of brings us full circle. But the biggest thing that I'm realizing is that the best way to keep people safe in my space is to move throughout the world in a way in which I create friends instead of enemies. I will never be safer. It doesn't matter how many guns I have or nuclear or whatever. I will never be safer than if everybody I come into contact with is a friend and not an enemy. And so the true, in my mind, the true paradigm of masculinity, again, I use that word true, just my latest, right, what feels most resonant with me in this moment, is a man who moves through the world creating friends instead of enemies, because that is what truly creates safety, is the ability to bring people in and connect deeply with them and their hearts and create brothers and sisters and siblings and family wherever you go. It's not necessarily the man who has the most guns or the biggest security system or the bulletproof Hummer that's the most embodied in creating safety. Because again, all of those things are a symptom of not feeling safe, right? All of the guns are a symptom of actually not moving through the world in a way where more safety is created. So, alright, well, those are my thoughts. I'm glad I finally got them out. I am praying that this recording comes out at least somewhat audible. But if not, I have the transcript as well. So hopefully that has also come through. Sometimes the way that the words come through in the transcription is so wild, and it's like confuses the meaning more than it clarifies it. But I'm so visual, I like to read along. So anyways, I hope everyone's having a beautiful day, and thanks for listening. And I just hit traffic, so be sitting behind this traffic for 24 minutes. This is a car crash. Praying and hoping it wasn't that person who went by me at 90 miles an hour. But anyways, have a beautiful rest of your evening, day, morning, month, year, decade, century, lifetime. And I'll see you all soon. Alright, love you all much. Bye.